Hi, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli, and we're also here with our very special Prison Pipeline Collective member hosts, Emma Lugo, Doug McVeigh, and Karen James. And we're here for a very special end of the year show.
And we are going to talk about a very controversial issue in Oregon this past year, which was the recriminalization by the Oregon legislature of certain drugs that were decriminalized in 2020 by an overwhelming ballot measure vote by Oregonians. So Doug is here with us. And Doug, tell a little bit about your background with drug policy reform.
Sure. I'm actually marking 4 decades in involvement in drug policy reform. Back in 1984, I got off a Greyhound bus and got onto Jack Hare's van, and he trained me up as a reefer raider. Went to work as at normal, and then doing a lot of other stuff in the meantime. I do drug policy work, and I do research and analysis. I mean, I've been looking at Oregon in particular for a long time, just because this is where I started and this is where I am. It's been fascinating watching the decrim, first of all, and then the recrim that's occurred in the development.
So, Doug, let's start with we have to go back to ballot measure 110 in 2020 to talk about decrim and recrim. So, explain measure 110.
Quite simply, Measure 110 was a ballot measure in the 2020 general election, which did a couple of things. One is that it decriminalized the possession of small amounts of several different illicit substances like heroin, cocaine, psilocybin, shortly after the measure passed. So as of February 1st of 2021, rather than being any kind of a misdemeanor, the possession of a small quantity would result in just a $100 fine that could be forgiven if the person would complete a health assessment. There's a 24-hour hotline that was supposed to eventually open up. You also had funding for these programs from the cannabis sales tax. And what it did, in essence, was to change the allocation, basically, how the marijuana revenue was divvied up. The Legislative Research Office put together a report back in 2022, basically explains it. Up to December of 2020, marijuana revenue was distributed each simply. Drug abuse and prevention got 5%. Cities and counties each got 10%. Then you got 15% that went to state police, 20% to mental health, 40% to state school fund. Then Measure 110 was passed, and that capped all these distributions to 11 and a quarter million quarter. And then all revenue above that is a $90 million biennium threshold. All of the revenue above that would go into this Drug Treatment and Recovery Services Fund. Now that fund, well, $302 million from the sales tax as of September of 2022. You've got there's a possibility that another $150 million or so will be going in 2025. It's it shifted money around. And what it's done is take some of this money and put it into services like housing, like peer counselors and such, which aren't otherwise being covered. And there's a huge funding gap that we face here in the state of Oregon in terms of our mental health services broadly, but behavioral health services and substance use services in particular. And I say it also made the change in the criminal law. So the idea was to sort of force a change within the system. We've already had drug courts in the state of Oregon. In fact, Multnomah County has the second oldest drug court program in the United States. Drug court started back in 1989 in Miami-Dade, Florida, under then State Attorney Janet Reno. Then, when she became Attorney General, they started popping up everywhere. And now there are more than 1,800 drug courts all over the United States, 24 around the state of Oregon. The problem is with drug courts, you've got people have to be arrested for one thing, then they have to qualify. There are a lot of different conditions people have to qualify for. Then once they're in there, there have to be services available for them to make use of. Otherwise, they're just going to be put back into the system. So anyway, that's the context of where we were before, and then Measure 110 made those changes.
And by the way, this was a ballot measure that Oregonians passed in 2020 by an overwhelming majority of 58.46%. So Oregonians took this into their own hands to make something happen and provide treatment and support for people who are suffering on the streets of Portland and elsewhere.
You know, what I really appreciated about that, Karen, was that, you know, you mentioned that this was, you know, a ballot initiative. This was passed by the voters. I mean, there wasn't a ballot initiative to revoke 110. That was something done by the state legislature.
You know, for what it's worth, because of COVID, largely, the number of actual possession arrests had already declined significantly. Like prior to the COVID-19, people were getting weekly numbers of well over 300 controlled substance arrests. These are fingerprinted arrests, so people aren't just being put in the back of the car and, you know, while they check warrants. This is taking them into the station and running their prints and putting them into the system, actually doing a proper, you're arrested at that point with the fingerprint ink and all that stuff. There's, you know, doing more than 300 people each week, or more than 300 arrests at least. Now, COVID-19 comes in, and suddenly at the end of March, it drops down to just to under 100. And then through a lot of 2020, the numbers are under 200 every week. And then ballot measure 110 passes, and after it goes into effect, the numbers drop to below 100. And they stayed below 100, although we still had, you know, 50 or 60, maybe down in the 40s, but several possession of controlled substance arrests every week, even after Measure 110, before it was recriminalized. So once it was recriminalized, the numbers shot back up again to over 200. I guess the last numbers are November 10th through 16th. There were only 157 arrests. These are the fingerprinted arrests. A total since September 1st, when drugs were recriminalized, the 1,407 possession of controlled substances arrests. And I should note also, these are the additional charges, right? So criminal trespass in the second degree was an additional charge in with these. Actually, 347 of those criminal trespasses. Failure to appear, there were 194 arrests on that, and 133 for bench warrants. So there are actually a lot of reasons why people are necessarily being arrested, aside from the controlled substance. That's just, you know, adding some time, adding some pressure. But that's one of the other interesting impacts. Like I say, we actually saw a decrease right before the ballot measure. These are really just to make the system work a little better, work a little easier. You have fewer people being rolled in and out of jail. And so you have, you know, the courts aren't feeling the pressure. The public defenders aren't being so overworked if you can find one. And so it just gets the system working a little bit more smoothly.
Measure 110 had a lot of issues. The rollout had problems and implementing it. That's why the legislature stepped in 2024. So what were some of the issues with implementing 110? And how were the providers, services, law enforcement, how was that involved with, or supposed to be involved with implementation of Measure 110?
Implementation problems. There were. The funding was certainly an issue, because funding didn't roll out the Oregon Health Authority before the monies that the Oversight Council had awarded could be distributed. The Oregon Health Authority objected because there were some issues. The requests weren't processed correctly. The requests had some other kinds of concerns. And so as a result, they needed a do-over, which delayed the release of these monies. Finally, they were able to get funds released. And so, yeah, there was a problem. The problem was the Oregon Health Authority was obstructionist and threw up roadblocks and refused to cooperate with the initial process, which meant that there were some delays with the funds. And again, that's the Oregon Health Authority. Why would they do that, you ask? Well, these monies are the sorts of monies that OHA has always been responsible for. And when you have ballot measure 110, which is passed with the argument that we not only need more money, but we need money to go into these other areas. We need to do something that we're not doing. What we're doing now doesn't work, means that the people doing that stuff now aren't doing a good enough job. So in a way, passing Measure 110 was a slap in the face to the Oregon Health Authority by saying that it wasn't doing its job well enough, so badly that we needed a new council to allocate hundreds of millions of dollars. And then the same with law enforcement, for saying, I mean, they're doing the job well enough, they shouldn't be doing that job at all, is what we're actually saying there. But any criticism will be taken as a criticism. So yeah, that was one of the problems with the rollout. And law enforcement did keep on making some arrests, and even when they weren't making controlled substance arrests, they were still harassing people who were unhoused people who should be getting their drugs seized, getting their paraphernalia taken and destroyed, people who use drugs, according to a survey that was done. By the way, there was a lot of research that's still being done on Measure 110 and its impact. It was a presentation back in January 2024 in Salem. A number of researchers from Research Triangle, RTI International, that is, from USC and from other places, law enforcement encounters after Measure 110, finding that some two-thirds of the people, they're now actually 70%, who were reporting a law enforcement encounter within the previous year. And I say it wasn't like law enforcement stopped, it just slowed down somewhat. So that was certainly a problem with the rollout. But otherwise, it wasn't supposed to solve the overdose crisis. We started seeing an uptick in overdoses here in Oregon very slightly up until 2020, and then it starts going upward because that's when fentanyl arrived.
What was the role of law enforcement supposed to be under Measure 110?
Stand back, stop interfering, stop making arrests. The point was that it's decriminalized. So these simple possession offenses weren't actual offenses. They could hand out these Class E violations and $100 fine. There was a delay in the establishment of the phone number. Did people make phone calls? Possibly not. They actually, as I understand, got very few. Did they pay their $100 fine? That's another one. And again, part of the problem with these arrests is these are nuisance arrests. These are sort of move people along kind of arrests. If you have a person who's unhoused and you shake them down, you find some drugs or some paraphernalia, or you say you smell something. And so you search them and you find something and oops, okay, well, you're going to jail now. And maybe they are, maybe they aren't. The policeman gets to play God for a little while with a person who's unhoused. That's the kind of stuff that Measure 110 tried to stop. And that's the kind of stuff that didn't stop, because police still have that kind of power to shake people down. They just did it less. And when they were doing it, they kept on making the arrests for things like criminal trespass and possibly for a warrant violation. Just, you know, get their ID and run their IDs and see what comes up. Yeah, but the difference was people weren't, as many people at least, weren't getting arrested and put into the system for simple possession. And when you look especially at the context of the COVID, at the best of times, courts are overcrowded and they run too slow, and we have the public defender crisis that we have going on. But during COVID, you had courts being closed. You know, things were going so much more slowly. So what kind of priority do you want within the criminal legal system? Is it really a first come, first serve? Because the cops can come up with a heck of a body count if all they're doing is arresting people for simple possession, right? But that's not going to stop the person who mugged you. That's not going to stop the person who broke into your home. That's not going to do anything about any of these other concerns. That's just getting somebody who made the mistake of lighting up a pipe in an alley when they thought they were cool, but the cop came around the corner too soon. It's because of the way we do drug policy. Overdoses, actually, Measure 110 had no impact on overdoses. We've got loads of published research. I've interviewed several of the people doing the research on this. It didn't really have much of an impact, except for the additional money finally going out to harm reduction organizations. We are starting to see a slight decline, probably because of the money that's now going to some of these organizations finally. Like I say, there were issues, but the issues were largely that OHA slowed down the distribution of funds, so it took a while for those to get out. But if you had postponed decrim, what exactly would have you done in the meantime with all these people? Because they're still cycling through the system, and you still got to do something. The number of people being arrested dropped, but you know, you would have still had an extra 100 people a week being put through the system. That's a big load. And that's the other thing. Now that you have people being arrested again, I am sure that you are going to have a demand from the police and a demand from the prosecutors for more money. And the corrections people, oh, we got to have more money because we're going to be processing people again. Look at all these arrests we're doing now. We got to get more money. So we're going to see demands from law enforcement and the prosecutors. And well, I mean, it's not a stretch to say that. If you look at the Behavioral Health Resource Network funding, the dashboards, I'm not very impressed. It's statewide here. They're talking about $20 million or so dollars of it, $6.6 million going for building everything. Delivery of services, that's $2.5 million. And services themselves, that's nearly $9 million, just $8.99. So they've got treatment there, housing, Can't tell you how much allocated to each because the way they've decided to do their table here and their chart, they're not including those numbers, even though they're in there. They obviously are in there. That's how the bar graphs are created. Anyway, in delivery, 14% of the total, that's 2.5 million, of which district attorney and law enforcement have a near even split with a tiny bit going to the courts and county internal partners.
What do you think the current situation would be if HB 4002 had not been passed and if the state had followed the voters' will, which was clearly Measure 110, the voters spoke loudly and clearly that they wanted to decriminalize small amounts of possession, and the state legislature acted against the voters' interests, basically upended Measure 110. What do you think the current situation would look like if we had simply allowed the voters' will to continue to be exercised in the state of Oregon?
HB 4002 was the bill passed by the legislature in the 24th session that recriminalized simple possession, changed that bit of Measure 110. The funding is still there at the moment, but the recrim, which was part of it, was to make the system more streamlined. It's nice to think that it's some kind of a handout or a favor to people who use drugs, and it's not a bad thing. But let's face it, most of this was about saving the system, and it did for a little while. But symbolically, it indicated that people who use drugs were not criminals. Just getting the general public to treat people who use drugs as human beings is a very difficult struggle. And that's what a lot of drug policy reform, a lot of harm reduction is really all about. I thought at the time that recrim was part of a sort of broader effort by the Democrats to appear that they could be tough on crime too, so that the Republicans would not have this talking point that they trot out in every election about the Democrats being soft on crime because Democrats are supposed to be more often than not sponsoring some of the criminal justice reform and prison reform. Not the only ones. Republicans get involved in it sometimes too, but it is perceived as one of those issues. And I wonder how much there was a level of pressure to take that away from the Republicans as a talking point.
House Bill 4002 brought about deflection, which was, I thought, what Measure 110 was all about, to deflect from the criminal legal system. Not give them citations, not arrest people first, but when a police officer encounters a person, to immediately take them or offer them treatment, do whatever they can to get this person to treatment, build that relationship.
Deflection is sort of the thing that comes before diversion. We had a thing called law enforcement assisted diversion that was developed in King County, Seattle, about a decade ago, and has since spread across the country. There was for a time a LEAD program here in Multnomah County. There still is a LEAD program in Salem. The idea is to respond without arresting people. It's at these first two what are called intercepts. You have a five intercept model, the sequential intercept. Intercept zero is community service. So that's crisis lines. There's a crisis care continuum. Intercept one is where law enforcement starts to get involved. That's like with a 911 call, local law enforcement just encounters someone. And this is all pre-arrest, okay? Intercept zero and intercept one is the stuff that's supposed to happen before arrest. And that was the innovation, I guess, of the LEAD model. I've spoken with the folks up in King County who put it together, the researchers who've worked on it. I'd say the idea was to have law enforcement would encounter people, but they wouldn't arresting people. They'd be getting to services. That's deflection, right? There's so you still have the LEAD program still there. LEADbureau.org is still out there assisting people with doing this. The problem with calling it law enforcement assisted diversion is you already have diversion. The idea of drug courts and treatment alternatives. I mean, treatment alternatives for safe communities was created in the late 1970s in Chicago and since went nationwide. As I say, drug courts started back in 89 and have been around the country for a long time. It's all based around this idea of therapeutic jurisprudence. There are a bunch of other kind of these courts, but the idea is to get people before they enter the court system, partly because once your system involved, it's just a nightmare, but also because it's so much cheaper to not get people in courts. So that's where this comes in. The drug courts are the diversion model, and that's what goes to intercept two. So it's initial detentions after the arrest. You have the detention and a court appearance, right? And you may have intercept three is specialty court. You may have jail, you may have a disposition, you may have a specialty court like a mental health court or a drug court. What we've had, let's see, in Oregon for a long time is the drug court model. Deflection would just be getting them out of the system before they can go in and start in with the court. Researchers have been looking at this. This here in Oregon, we established de jure, you know, by law, drug decriminalization. But in other places around the country, Baltimore notably, but other places as well, you've had what's called de facto decriminalization. That is to say, it's just not going to be treated as a criminal offense. They just don't have the capacity. So it's policy, even though it's not law, it's just don't do these arrests. If a body count is what you're looking for, then drug arrests are a great way to generate a body count. And if not seeing that body count night after night makes you think that the war is not being won, then, you know, people panic. And the war is not being won. It's time to declare victory and get the hell out. But until then, we have all this. So yeah, deflection programs, the idea was to get people before that, not even involving police, I say. But it's a tough model to get police to wrap their heads around because they want to come in and move people along.
Doug, one of the problems, as we've addressed so far, is the lack of uniformity among counties. I mean, we know that HB 4002 is the law, but that doesn't mean that the essence of Measure 110 isn't still in effect, because I would contest that there really is very little enforcement going on in Portland. So my question is, there's a real lack of uniformity among counties in terms of how Measure 110 was implemented, and, you know, with distribution of services and deflection and all of the issues that went into it, which are still issues. So how can we address the issue of the lack of uniformity among counties?
And also, if I could add to that, how are we going to measure success? If each county is doing everything so differently, how are we going to measure success?
First, I'll say in terms of, you know, what's happening, one of the differences if we hadn't had HB 4002 is that there are hundreds of arrests that wouldn't have been made. Small, petty offenses in Multnomah County. Portland Police Bureau alone, since September 1st of 24, has made 212 arrests for possession of controlled substance, what would have been decrimmed under Measure 110. They've made more than 200 arrests for that. Everybody feels safer? In terms of the uniformity in counties, that's one of the big issues. And it's police department to police department, too. You'll have some counties like Douglas County that are renowned for being rather harsh on drug offenses. And marijuana enforcement was just horrible back in the 80s. And then you've got a problem of getting, you know, enough resources to people in terms of health care, not just behavioral health and mental health services and substitute services, but you've also got, you know, simple health care. I was looking at the numbers, and there's a lot of the state of Oregon that is by definition rural. I mean, there are some counties that are by definition frontier, you know, more by census, more cattle than people. You know, and getting resources in a place like that, if you're someone who has some kind of a mental health issue or a substance use issue or a physical health issue, is real hard, which is one of the things that drives people to come to the city so they can access the resources that are here and the services that are in the metro areas. And until you've got that discrepancy, disparity in resource access, then it just makes the problem so much worse. You know, make a mistake in one county and you might get a long sentence. In another county, you might have gotten probation, or they might not have even had time to get to your case because the courts are so backed up. Rural areas are always getting the short end of the stick in terms of funding. The second part, measuring success, is actually that brings up the most difficult part. This is the thing about drug policy reform that I've always found fascinating. The criminal legal system, all these things, I look at all these numbers, like the numbers of arrests and the clearance rates. That's the number of these offenses that are cleared by the police, by law enforcement, by the prosecutors. They've basically got enough to make an indictment. It doesn't mean anybody's been found guilty. It just means they found enough to pin the blame on somebody, and we'll see what the court says, or yet they've indicted someone. And the clearance rates are horrible. Nationally, it's like less than 20% property crimes, and that's consistent. In fact, it's been bad some years. 20% is good. We've only hit 20% about once in the last decade. And for violent offenses, it's less than 50%. And that's a clearance rate. And that's for the reported offenses, because then there are all the offenses that don't get reported because people don't think that involving the police is going to help, or that the police will do anything, or that maybe calling police just means the wrong people get arrested because call 911 in the wrong neighborhood and everybody's going to jail. But at least you have numbers you can quantify, right? We've got the surveys, we've got the data from the Uniform Crime Report. We can quantify these numbers. We can see what those are. Say in 2022, According to the UCR, we had less than a million drug arrests in the United States, 900,000, just over 900,000, which is remarkable. In 2020, it was 1.1 million total arrests. Of those in 2020, just over a million were for possession. In 2022, it's nearly 800,000. So the majority of these arrests are for possession, right? 800,000 arrests for possession. Okay, fine. But how many people are actually doing drugs, and how many times during the year are they in possession of drugs? So how many offenses are these people generating, right? If you're a daily user of heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine, then you're in possession, say, 300 days out of the year. And say you get arrested once. What's the clearance rate on that? Less than 1%. And that's for the people getting arrested. It's the thing about the drug war. There is no way to really show success. You can show that they're seizing increasing numbers of drugs. You can look in the news media for some examples of that with fentanyl seizures that you've seen reported on. And for extra bonus, you repeat the news release at every step along the way. So you'll see that news release about that fentanyl seizure when these guys go to court, and you'll see it again when they get sentenced. But you may not notice that. All you'll see is X kilograms seized. Ooh, look at all that. And that's all you'll get. And it's possible that if it's enough, if it's big enough, they'll cut a deal and they'll be in witness protection and they'll be rolling on their friends. And and they'll be living on the government dime while doing it.
Doug, so let's look ahead now. What is projected to happen in the 2025 legislative session?
Well, this is going to be interesting. As it is now, the head of the Oregon Justice Commission testified on deflection programs back in, I think it was September, before the joint hearing of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. And he was asked, you know, what are these deflection programs? To talk about deflection programs. And the description that he gave was broad enough to include diversion and sort of drug court light kind of stuff and post-arrest, and very much not what deflection is supposed to be about. And he was taken to task by Senator Brzezinski. To his credit, Senator Brzezinski, they schooled him well, and Senator Brzezinski was quite direct and very much on target. And this was prepared testimony. So yeah, I think what we're going to see, unfortunately, will be the Justice Commission failing to make these distinctions, and the legislature is going to have to stand up, because I think they're getting pressure from the counties who don't want to do deflection because they don't want to be seen as soft, or maybe just because they hate people who use drugs. I don't know. We'll see what happens moving forward. But again, it's concerning that we're seeing that kind of thing from the state agency.
If I can do my own commentary here, not only for the people suffering with substance use disorder or mental illness who these policies are supposed to be helping, I want to also give a shout out to the unsung heroes who are the peers, the mental health workers, the people out in the community, the people doing outreach, trying to build relationships with these folks out in the streets, provide them with what they need. And sometimes it's just basic needs. Just a shout out, kudos to all of those unsung heroes in our communities.
Yeah, this is a really good show, Doug. Thank you so much for helping to inform us about the status of changes regarding Measure 110 and helping us to kind of understand the complexities of what's happening right now.
I'm grateful to all of you for allowing me the honor of being part of this collective. We've been able to talk about some really cutting edge stuff. It's just been a great honor.
And from all of us at Prison Pipeline, all the best to all of our listeners in 2025.